ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When we lose someone we love, we can feel an incredible range of emotions, some of them quite unexpected. In September 2020, when parts of the country were struggling with the fear and the reality of death from COVID, writer Nova Wheatman was caring for her partner of 25 years in their home as he was dying from cancer. And after he died, she found herself contemplating how you grieve amid the responsibilities of daily life, and also how you grieve a not quite perfect relationship, as they all are, no matter how much love they contained. The resulting memoir is called Love, Death and Other Scenes. Nova Wheatman, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks, Hilary. Nice to be here.
First up, I'm sorry for your loss.
But thank you.
Tell us a bit about Aidan and what it was like when you first met.
Oh, well, I saw him. This is such a kind of creepy story, but I saw him through the window of an op shop, like probably 5 years before we started going out. And I saw him and I just thought, oh, and he was trying on a suit or something or a jacket. And he had this big kind of black coiffed hair like Morrissey. And I thought, oh, he is handsome. I'm going to date him one day. And then I turned up to work for a friend's theatre company for nothing, as we all did back in those days. And there he was down the end of the table. And he ignored me for a good couple of years, I think.
That creepy woman that was looking at me through the shop window.
I know, I think it was a bit of that. But, so he was incredibly funny and dry and often very sarcastic and had a kind of brilliant story brain, which I just fell in love with as a young writer, I think.
Well, you collaborated on a short film early on
too.
We did.
It was called Mr. Wazinski's Song. And it was based on I wrote the short story, and it was about a Polish man who lost his hearing during World War II when he had gauze stuck in his ears after a bomb blast as a child. And then he kind of later on in Melbourne starts hearing sounds of war, and he goes to the doctor, and the doctor pulls this kind of extracts the gauze wads out of his ears, and he starts hearing horrific kind of, I guess, just reminding him of what his childhood was. And so I wrote it and Aidan directed it. And it was, surprisingly, there were no fights. No, collaborating with your partner isn't always a good idea, but it was great. And it went on, it did really well, that film. We took it overseas and it screened in Germany and London film festivals. And it was just lovely. And we tried to work together multiple times, but making films in this country, as everyone knows, is very hard. So we sort of fled back to our respective industries.
Well, I mean, literary history is rich with examples of how that doesn't work.
Doesn't work, yeah.
Yeah, two writers in the same house battling for space and time.
Yeah, yeah.
How did it go with you?
It worked. It did. It was like surprisingly easy. And I'm not sure if I think we were lucky because it was the 90s and the 2000s and I think or 2000s and 2010s. I think it was a lucky time to have no money in Melbourne. I look at my 19-year-old and think, wow, how are you going to manage a life like this? It's pretty hard. So we managed in rental, sad falling down rental houses and on piecemeal kind of jobs. But we just always understood that that was what we both wanted to do, I think. And basically neither of us were very good at anything else. So he was at his heart a playwright, a sad, angry playwright who, you know, whinged about the state of the industry frequently. And I loved writing whatever form it took, and it sort of eventually found books. But he could fix my stories and I could help him in other ways. So I think we just had a beautiful kind of cohesive way of working together.
And I mean, the quite different writing styles and different kind of fields of literary endeavour.
Yeah.
How was that for you guys?
Well, I think I never tried to step. I did actually write a short play once and realised that I could never get actors on and off the stage. So they had to be on the stage the whole time. So I kind of respected his art form, I think. I loved watching, when on an opening night, watching how he changed, watching who he became. I think there's this joy of loving an artist that you see them in a very different way publicly. And I respected his ability to kind of create humour and pathos and poignancy on stage in a really moving way. And I loved writing books, and he was not a big reader of fiction. So we had just naturally had very different spaces, I think, to work in. So we were never competing, but we were in support of each other.
Well, and we're speaking with Nova Wheatman, who is a very much loved and respected writer for adults and young adults, this fantastic niche you've carved for yourself in Australian writing, Nova. And you're very candid in the memoir, Love, Death and Other Scenes, which is not for young people. It's about your journey with Aidan. You're very candid about the fact that your relationship, like every relationship, has some ups and downs, but there were some big ones with Aidan.
There was.
Tell us about the time when he called you and told you that you needed to come to Sydney urgently.
So Aidan had a play on up in Sydney and he rang me and he said, I can't leave the hotel room. And I was like, I don't know what's going on. So I sort of left the kids with my dad and flew to Sydney and got there. And he just, the hotel room just was, just it just felt like sadness. There was just a smell of wine and cigarettes and he was smoking, which he hadn't done for many years. And I sort of managed to coax him out of the hotel. We got to the opening night of the play and then we fled and he clearly just could barely even get on the plane to come home. And he got home and he just went to bed for months. And he'd sort of lost a number of members of his family at that point. And there'd just been years of loss and grieving and this kind of sad, just at his core, I think, that he hadn't processed. And so he had a really huge breakdown and started drinking a lot. And it just was a very hard time to live with him and live with, you know, for the kids and for me, I think. And eventually his three kind of closest female friends took him into their houses in St Kilda and sort of shuffled him from one house to the other until he made the decision to stop drinking. And he did.
That's a bit like King Lear, isn't it?
I know. It was quite extraordinary. These three women were just, yeah, they were. They saved us all, I think.
Yeah, better outcome than
better,
King Lear.
Yeah, better, much better outcome.
So, I mean, yeah, it's really fascinating to read through the book and just go, okay, there's these times in your life, there's better times, there's difficult times. Tell us about the time when Aidan joined a choir, because that sounds lovely.
It was. It was beautiful. Beautiful. And I think that's the thing with grief and life and long relationships. There's those bumps and those hard, really hard times. And I think then hopefully things start to swing. And the choir came about. We went to see, my daughter was in a school concert and she was in a choir and singing with this, just this beautiful song with these incredible kind of young voices. And Aidan and I were just sitting there eating chips for dinner and he just sort of said, oh, that's what I need. I need to join a choir. And so he joined a choir called Pagan Angels at the Abbotsford Convent, run by a kind of mighty choir conductor, Sue Johnson. And it just changed him, I think. I think it gave him purpose. It gave him a freedom to be vulnerable. It gave him a place to sing. And I think singing is just, if you can, I cannot, sadly, Hillary, if you can sing, it's just a joyful, beautiful thing to do with other people. And he had a beautiful voice. And so he came home really proud. And also just with this private thing that was his and it wasn't about the rest of us. And I think that was really important for him.
Yeah. And I guess he wasn't trying to prove himself on a stage as well, with a whole bunch of other people involved in a project.
It wasn't. And it wasn't really a performative choir. Like it was more for them. And I think there's something beautiful about doing and performing as an artist, but in a quite a private way. I think we often make it performative and this wasn't. So I think that was really special.
Yeah. So step up from being in the shower. Yeah. Collective.
Or the lovely car. That's where I sing.
Yeah, exactly. Enclosed.
No one can hear me.
Soundproof spaces. We're speaking with Nova Wheatman about her new memoir, among other things. It's called Love, Death and Other Scenes. So the clue is in the title, really.
Yeah.
It's about Nova and Aidan and the way that they progressed through the Aidan's illness. He was diagnosed with cancer. And I noticed at one point he after the diagnosis, he was really grappling with it and he asked you and the kids not to come to a performance. What was going on for him then?
That was actually such a kind of hard moment, I think, because the choir only, at that period, the choir only sang once publicly and they were performing at the Abbotsford Convent and Aidan was going to sing the lead in the Nick Cave song Into Your Arms or the solo. And I was sort of in the gym doing pricing Barbies for my son's school fete, as you do. I used to run the toy stall. And Aidan turned up and just said, you can't come. I just don't think I'll make it if you guys are there. And I really didn't understand, actually. I found that really hard. And it took me a long time just to understand that he knew he wouldn't manage to get through it had we been there. I think it was having us there was too much of a reminder of what he was about to lose, which he knew that he was going to die. And he just couldn't kind of process that. So we didn't come. And then the choir actually sang Into Your Arms at the book launch with a lovely man, Matt, who knew Aidan as the soloist, and it was, everyone just sobbed. It was the most beautiful thing to see it, to finally see it, I think, was really special.
Yeah, I love these moments of catharsis that you relate in the book to, where people actually get a chance to grieve and to pour out that love for the person, because you write a lot about how we deal with grief in Australia or don't. Tell us a little bit, though, about how it was dealing with Aidan's illness during lockdown in Melbourne, because that was a really big constraint.
Yeah, it was really hard. I think, and it's been interesting since the book's come out, because people have written to me about this, about looking after loved ones, and particularly obviously if you had someone in a nursing home that you were trying to care for. We made the choice to keep Aidan home because a palliative care ward would have meant the children couldn't see him, and that was really important that they could. So Aidan stayed home, but I don't think either of us realised how the cancer was going to progress. We weren't really accessing medical specialists very easily at that time because of COVID. And so once he became bedbound, basically it was up to me to sort of get him up and help him go to the toilet and shower, well, not shower, but wash and change clothes. And so I became his carer, which is a really hard, I just think it's an incredibly hard thing to shift your relationship quickly from kind of lover to carer with two young children at home doing homeschooling in COVID when no one can really be in your house with you.
And he resisted that shift, didn't he?
He did. He really did. And I think, yeah, I think he did. I think it was just him also trying to get his head around the idea that he was dying. And I think that is such a huge thing for someone to understand. And particularly when you're siloed the way we were, we could just couldn't access people or connections or so that was, yeah, it was a very hard time. We relied on friends delivering meals, and just the four of us lived in this house with this crazy cat that I adopted in the midst of it all.
As you do, you take on one more thing.
Just to try and give some joy to everyone, we threw a cat in the mix, and she did bring great joy at times. So, yeah, it was pretty hard.
Nova, tell us about the Sunday afternoon in September in 2020. Aidan was nearing the end, and you were booked in to do an online author interview for a literary festival.
It sounds ludicrous, yeah.
I loved that passage. Tell us how it played out.
Oh, I think about that now and just think, what was I doing? But I think as any freelance worker knows, and especially during the pandemic when none of us were working, we had no income and we were pretty broke. I had been booked to speak online at a writer's festival, and I thought, oh, that's fine. That's just an hour. One of Aidan's really dear friends could come. She was actually a qualified nurse, which was fantastic. So she came to look after him, and I joined the Zoom, sat upstairs. Our son went off roller skating with his friends down the street. He was 12, and our daughter was home. And I literally logged onto the Zoom, and then Aidan's friend Barb yelled from the bedroom, and I ran downstairs, left the screen open, so it was clear something had happened. And then Barb kind of came back upstairs and closed the screen. And then Aidan just died really quickly in the room with me and Evie and Barb in the room. And it was such a weird kind of moment because people were texting me going, we saw you flee the screen. We know that something's happened. And it just all, it was almost like he was waiting for me not to be in the room before he could leave, I think. That's what I feel. It feels like now.
Well, it reads a bit like, don't come to this performance. I can't sing this love song in front of the person I love most, and I'm going
to
lose.
Yeah, that's exactly what it felt like, that we just had to leave him to do it on his own, to do that quiet business on his own. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, death is such a weird thing, isn't it? Because it's that quiet business that's so internal and so powerful.
Yeah.
And then you have to deal with the practicalities. And that was quite surreal in your case, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, because we couldn't have a funeral. We couldn't, five people at a funeral. So, and the funeral home who came to, well, the men who came to pick up Aidan's body, they turned up and they collected him in our house. And it was the first time anyone had hugged me for months and months and months because of the pandemic. And this stranger reached down and gave me a hug. And it was a very weird moment. And then they took Aidan's body away. And even that, like taking someone from the house where you have to check that no one's in the street, just the strange things that I'd never considered. And then we had to get a government permission to cross the Ring of Steel in order to go and say goodbye to Aidan at the funeral home because it was outside, it was in regional Melbourne, Victoria. And even that was just all these kind of strange elements to what is normally quite a mundane end of kind of back end process, I think, after someone dies. And this just wasn't. So, yeah, very odd.
Yeah. Well, and like many of us, you read what other writers have said on grief to try to understand, you know, what's going on in your head. What was that like for you? Did it provide the comfort and illumination you were seeking?
Sometimes. I think it's always just really lonely, isn't it, when someone dies? It doesn't matter who the person is, just someone that you love. And I think you're trying to work out your pecking order in grief, whether you are deserving of sympathy, depending on how close the person was to you. And I think there's a weird kind of, there's all these weird elements to when we grieve. So I desperately wanted and soaked up whatever I could read because I couldn't really see my friends or my people. And sometimes other people's writings just made me frustrated because their experiences were so different. And I felt like I had to step into this pragmatic space. I couldn't be magically kind of dwelling on what had happened. I had to just put the bins out and look after the kids and help with homeschooling. And I really had to just nurture them, I guess, and hold them together. So I couldn't really fall apart. So that's, I think I wanted to write a much more pragmatic book about that experience.
Yeah, you're not nipping off to the beach house in white linen and contemplating,
are you? That'd be nice at any time, though, wouldn't it?
Well, I love this. This fantastic snippet that pops up in an article on this, Nova, that you and the kids became obsessed with a particular computer game.
Oh, we did. Yeah. We played Zelda. I don't think we've actually played it since. It's such an interesting thing. My kids had never really had video games. And you know, I think in that attempt to make their lives okay, while they were watching this awful thing unravel in their house, I went and bought a Nintendo Switch or whatever it is, and a Zelda game. And we all became obsessed, and we used to fight over who was playing at what time. And it was pure escapism, but it was also the three of us played it in very different ways. So my son just wanted to finish first. My daughter just wanted to do sort of all the, she was very, the way she approached it was very much the way she approaches everything. So it was like doing the temples and sort of a quest, almost like accepting the quest. And I just wanted to kill things, which just was so out of character for me. But I think I just needed this, just pure escape, I think. But that sense that we were playing a video game where you couldn't die, and there is something so obscure and weird about that, like thinking about bringing a video game into the house where that is the very nature of it, that you are immortal. You just reset the game and you come back to life again. And yeah, it just ran so counter to what we were experiencing, I guess.
But it just speaks to the fact that you do what you need to do to
Absolutely.
Get you through, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be different for everyone. There's going to be weird stuff. You might get a cat.
Yeah.
You know, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Nova, did writing this memoir, which is such a kind of partly a love letter to Aidan.
It is, yeah.
And partly, you know, a meditation and an exploration of how people do grief and dying.
Yeah.
Did it help to process all the multitude of things you'd been through?
It helped to think about loss in lots of forms, I think, and the much more broader way that we all lose. We you know, losses of, you know, just the nature of aging or of our children growing up or losing our looks or not, you know, my knees aching or whatever those small losses were. I think what it also did, and this is the kind of the beautiful part of it, was that it gave me space to think about Aidan, and it gave me space to think about the two of us. And I don't think we do that when we're facing the death of someone or we're grieving someone. We're thinking about them as being sick and we stay in that space. And I think to have time, the luxury of time of looking back over our lives together, was such a beautiful kind of privilege and gift in a way. So that's what it gave me. It just gave me, yeah, space, I think.
Well, and as Annabelle Crabb says on the front cover, this is a beautiful, generous book. It's a gift to other people as well. Nova Wheatman, thanks for joining us on Life Matters.
Thanks, Hilary.
You're listening to RN. Nova has taken a turn away from writing for young people with a memoir called Love, Death and Other Scenes.
Getting in touch with ABC RN is easy. Join the conversation live using the ABC Listen app's call and text features.